The problem wasn't that difficult, but as he put it, it was harder to solve the problem when you are anticipated to solve it quickly. It might have taken him as long as 2 minutes to finish. The second question the Goldman managing director asked him was more involved and involving. He described for Serge a room, a rectangular box, and gave him its three dimensions. He says there is a spider on the floor, and he gives me its coordinates. There is also a fly on the ceiling, and he gives me its coordinates as well. Then he asked the question, calculate the shortest distance a spider can take to reach the fly. The spider can't fly or swing. It can only walk on surfaces. The shortest path between two points was a straight line, and so, Serge figured, it was a matter of unfolding the box, turning a three-dimensional object into a two-dimensional surface, then using the Pythagorean theorem to calculate the distances. This took him several minutes to work out. When he was done, Davidovich offered him a job at Goldman Sachs. His starting salary plus bonus came to $270,000. He joined Goldman at an interesting moment in the history of both the firm and Wall Street. By mid-2007, Goldman's bond trading department was aiding and abetting a global financial crisis, most infamously by helping the Greek government to rig its books and disguise its debt, and by designing subprime mortgage securities to fail so that they might make money by betting against them. At the same time, Goldman's equities department was adapting to radical changes in the U.S. stock market, just as that market was about to crash. A once sleepy oligopoly dominated by NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange was rapidly turning into something else. The 13 public stock exchanges in New Jersey were all trading the same stocks. Within a few years, there would be more than 40 dark pools, two of them owned by Goldman Sachs, also trading the same stocks. The fragmentation of the American stock market was fueled in part by Reg NMS, which had also stimulated a huge amount of stock market trading. Much of the new volume was generated not by old-fashioned investors, but by the extremely fast computers controlled by the high-frequency trading firms. Essentially, the more places there were to trade stocks, the greater the opportunity there was for high-frequency traders to interpose themselves between buyers on one exchange and sellers on another. This was perverse. The initial promise of computer technology was to remove the intermediary from the financial market, or at least reduce the amount he could scalp from that market. The reality turned out to be a windfall for financial intermediaries of somewhere between $10 billion and $22 billion a year, depending on whose estimates you wanted to believe. For Goldman Sachs, a financial intermediary, that was only good news. The bad news was that Goldman Sachs wasn't yet making much of the new money. At the end of 2008, they told their high-frequency trading computer programmers that their trading unit had netted roughly $300 million. That same year, the high-frequency trading division of a single hedge fund, Citadel, made $1.2 billion. The HFT guys were already known for hiding their profits, but a lawsuit between one of them, a Russian named Misha Malyshev, and his former employer, Citadel, revealed that in 2008, Malyshev had been paid $75 million in cash. Rumors circulated, they turned out to be true, of two guys who had left Knight for Citadel and guarantees of $20 million a year each. A headhunter who sat in the middle of the market and saw what firms were paying for geek talent says, Goldman had started to figure it out, but they really hadn't figured it out. They weren't top 10. The simple reason Goldman wasn't making much of the big money now being made in the stock market was that the stock market had become a war of robots, and Goldman's robots were slow. A lot of the money-making strategies were of the winner-take-all variety. When every player is trying to do the same thing, the player who gets all the money is the one whose computers can take in data and spit out the obvious response to it first. In the various races being run, Goldman was seldom first. That is why they had sought out Serge Alenikov in the first place, to improve the speed of their system. There were many problems with that system, in Serge's view. It wasn't so much a system as an amalgamation. The code development practices at IDT were much more organized and up-to-date than at Goldman, he says. Goldman had bought the core of its system 15 years earlier in the acquisition of one of the early electronic trading firms, Hull Trading. The massive amounts of old software, Serge guessed that the entire platform had as many as 60 million lines of code in it, and 15 years of fixes to it had created the computer equivalent of a giant rubber band ball. When one of the rubber bands popped, Serge was expected to find it and fix it. Goldman Sachs often used complexity to advantage. The firm designed complex subprime mortgage securities that others did not understand, for instance, and then took advantage of the ignorance they had introduced into the marketplace. The automation of the stock market created a different sort of complexity, with lots of unintended consequences. One small example, Goldman's trading on the NASDAQ exchange. In 2007, Goldman owned the unmarked building closest to NASDAQ. The building housed Goldman's dark pool. When Serge arrived, tens of thousands of messages per second were flying back and forth between computers inside the two buildings. Proximity, he assumed, must offer Goldman Sachs some advantage. After all, why else buy the building closest to the exchange? But when he looked into it, he found that to cross the street from Goldman to NASDAQ, a signal took 5 milliseconds, or nearly as much time as it would take a couple of years later for a signal to travel on the fastest network from Chicago to New York. The theoretical limit of sending a signal from Chicago to New York and back is something like 7 milliseconds, said Serge. Everything more than that is the friction caused by man. The friction could be caused by physical distance, say if the signal moving across a street in Carteret traveled in something less direct than a straight line. It could be caused by computer hardware. But it could also be caused by slow, clunky software. And that was Goldman's problem. Their high-frequency trading platform was designed, in typical Goldman style, as a centralized hub-and-spoke system. Every signal sent was required to pass through the mothership in Manhattan before it went back out into the marketplace. But the latency, the 5 milliseconds, wasn't mainly due to the physical distance, says Serge. It was because the traffic was going through layers and layers of corporate switching equipment. Broadly speaking, there were three problems Serge had been hired to solve. They corresponded to the three stages of an electronic trade. The first was to create the so-called ticker plant, or the software that translated the data from the 13 public exchanges so that it could be viewed as a single stream. Reg NMS had imposed on the big banks a new obligation to take in the information from all the exchanges in order to ensure that they were executing customers' orders at the official best market price, the NBBO. If Goldman Sachs purchased 500 shares of IBM at $20 a share on the New York Stock Exchange on behalf of a customer without first taking the 100 shares of IBM offered at $19.99 on the BATS Exchange, they'd have violated the regulation. The easiest and cheapest solution for the big banks to this problem was to use the combined data stream created by public exchanges, the SIP. Some of them did just that. But to assuage the concerns of their customers that the SIP was too slow and offered them a dated view of the market, a few banks promised to create a faster data stream, but nothing they created for customers' orders was as fast as what they created for themselves. Serge had nothing to do with anything used by Goldman's customers. His job was to build the system that Goldman Sachs' own proprietary traders would use in their activities. And it went without saying that it needed to be faster than anything used by the customers. The first and most obvious thing he did to make Goldman's robots faster was exactly what he had done at IDT to enable millions of phone calls to find their cheapest route. He decentralized Goldman's system. Rather than have signals travel from the various exchanges back to the Goldman hub, he set up separate mini Goldman hubs inside each of the exchanges. To acquire the information for its private ticker plant, Goldman needed to place its computers as close as possible to the exchange's matching engine. The software that took the output from the ticker plant and used it to figure out smart trades in the stock market was the second stage of the process. Serge rewrote a lot of that code to make it run faster. The third stage was called order entry. As it sounds, this was the software that sent those trades back out into the market to be executed. Serge worked on that too. He didn't think of it this way, but in effect, he was building a high-frequency trading firm within Goldman Sachs. The speed he created for Goldman Sachs could be used for many purposes, of course. It could be used simply to execute Goldman's prop traders' smart strategies as quickly as possible. It could also be used by Goldman's prop traders to trade the slow-moving customer orders in their own dark pool against the wider market. The speed Serge gave them could be used, for example, to sell Chipotle Mexican Grill to Rich Gates at a high price in the dark pool while buying it from him at a lower price on a public exchange. Serge actually didn't know what the speed was being used for by Goldman's prop traders. As he worked, he became aware of a gulf in understanding between himself and his employer. The people at Goldman with whom he dealt understood the effects of what he did, but not their deep causes. No one at Goldman had a global view of the firm's computer software, for instance. He figured that out on the first day, when they asked him to look into the code base and figure out how the different components talked to each other. In doing so, he saw that there was shockingly little documentation left behind by the people who had written that code, and that no one at Goldman could explain it to him. He, in turn, was not privy to the commercial effects of his actions, in part, he sensed, because his superiors did not want him to know them. "I think it is done intentionally," he said. "The less you know about how they make the money, the better it is for them." But even if they had wanted him to know how the money was made, it is unclear Serge would have cared to know. "I think the engineering problems are much more interesting than the business problems," he says. "Finance is just who gets the money. Does it wind up in the right pocket or the left pocket? It just so happens that the companies that make money are the companies like Goldman Sachs. You can't really win in that game unless you are one of these people." He understood that Goldman's quants were forever dreaming up new trading strategies in the form of algorithms for his robots to execute, and that these traders were meant to be extremely shrewd. He grasped further that all their algorithms are premised on some sort of prediction, predicting something 1 second into the future. But you needed only to observe the 2008 stock market crash from inside of Goldman Sachs, as Serge had, to see that what seemed predictable often was not. Day after volatile day in September 2008, Goldman's supposedly brilliant traders were losing tens of millions of dollars. All of the expectations didn't work, recalls Serge. They thought they controlled the market, but it was an illusion. Everyone would come into work and were blown away by the fact that they couldn't control anything at all. Finance is a gambling game for people who enjoy gambling. He wasn't a gambler by nature. He preferred the deterministic world of programming to the pseudo-deterministic world of speculation, and he never fully grasped the connection between his work and the Goldman traders. What Serge did know about Goldman's business was that the firm's position in the world of high-frequency trading was insecure. The traders were always afraid of the small HFT shops, as he put it. He was making Goldman's bulky, inefficient system faster, but he could never make it as fast as a system built from scratch, without the burden of 60 million lines of old code underneath it, or a system that, to change it in any major way, did not require 6 meetings and signed documents from informational security officers. Goldman hunted in the same jungle as the small HFT firms, but it could never be as quick or as nimble as those firms. No big Wall Street bank could. The only advantage a big bank enjoyed was its special relationship to the prey, its customers. As the head of one high-frequency trading firm put it, when one of these people from the banks interviews with us for a job, he always talks about how smart his algos are. But sooner or later, he'll tell you that without his customers, he can't make any money. After a few months working on the 42nd floor at 1 New York Plaza, Serge came to the conclusion that the best thing they could do with Goldman's high-frequency trading platform was to scrap it and build a new one from scratch. His bosses weren't interested. The business model of Goldman Sachs was, if there is an opportunity to make money right away, let's do that, he says. But if there was something long-term, they weren't that interested. Something would change in the stock market. An exchange would introduce a new, complicated rule, for instance, and that change would create an immediate opportunity to make money. They'd want to do it immediately, says Serge. But if you think about it, it's just patching the existing system constantly. The existing code base becomes an elephant that's difficult to maintain. That is how he spent the vast majority of his 2 years at Goldman, patching the elephant. For their patching material, he and the other Goldman programmers resorted every day to open-source software, software developed by collectives of programmers and made freely available on the Internet. The tools and components they used were not specifically designed for financial markets, but they could be adapted to repair Goldman's plumbing. He discovered, to his surprise, that Goldman had a one-way relationship with open source. They took huge amounts of free software off the web, but they did not return it after he had modified it, even when his modifications were very slight and of general rather than financial use. Once I took some open source components, repackaged them to come up with a component that was not even used at Goldman Sachs, he says. It was basically a way to make two computers look like one, so if one went down, the other could jump in and perform the task. He'd created a neat way for one computer to behave as the stand-in for another. He described the pleasure of his innovation this way. It created something out of chaos. When you create something out of chaos, essentially, you reduce the entropy in the world. He went to his boss, a fellow named Adam Schlesinger, and asked if he could release it back into open source, as was his inclination. He said it was now Goldman's property, recalls Serge. He was quite tense. Open source was an idea that depended on collaboration and sharing, and Serge had a long history of contributing to it. He didn't fully understand how Goldman could think it was okay to benefit so greatly from the work of others and then behave so selfishly toward them. "You don't create intellectual property," he said. "You create a program that does something." But from then on instructions from Adam Schlesinger, he treated everything on Goldman Sachs servers, even if it had just been transferred there from open source, as Goldman Sachs property. Later, at his trial, his lawyer flashed 2 pages of computer code, the original with its open source license on top, and a replica with the open source license stripped off and replaced by the Goldman Sachs license. The funny thing was that Serge actually liked Adam Schlesinger and most of the other people he worked with at Goldman. He liked less the environment the firm created for them to work in. "Everyone lived for the year-end number," he said. "You get satisfied when the bonus is sizable, and you get not satisfied when the number is not. Everything there is very possessive." It made no sense to him the way people were paid individually for achievements that were essentially collective achievements. It was quite competitive. Everyone's trying to show how good their individual contribution to the team is. Because the team doesn't get the bonus, the individual does. More to the point, he felt that the environment Goldman created for its employees did not encourage good programming, because good programming required collaboration. Essentially, there was very minimal connections between people, he says. In telecom, you usually have some synergies between people, meetings when people exchange ideas. They aren't under stress in the same way. At Goldman, it was always, "Some component is broken, and we're losing money because of it. Fix it now!" The programmers assigned to fix the code sat in cubicles and hardly spoke to one another. "When the two people wanted to talk, they wouldn't just do it out on the floor," says Serge. "They would go to one of the offices around the floor and close the door. I never had that experience in telecom or academia." By the time the financial crisis hit, Serge had a reputation of which he himself was unaware. He was known to corporate recruiters outside Goldman as the best programmer in the firm. "There were 20 guys on Wall Street who could do what Serge could do," says a headhunter who recruits often for high-frequency trading firms. "And he was one of the best, if not the best." Goldman also had a reputation in the market for programming talent, for keeping its programmers in the dark about their value to the firm's trading activities. The programmer types were different from the trader types. The trader types were far more alive to the bigger picture, to their context. They knew their worth in the marketplace down to the last penny. They understood the connection between what they did and how much money was made, and they were good at exaggerating the importance of the link. Serge wasn't like that. He was a little picture person, a narrow problem solver. "I think he didn't know his own value," says the recruiter. "He compensated for being narrow by being good. He was that good." Given his character and his situation, it's hardly surprising that the market kept finding Serge Alenikoff and telling him what he was worth, rather than the other way around. A few months into his new job, headhunters were calling him every other week. A year into his new job, he had an offer from UBS, the Swiss bank, and a promise to bump up his salary to $400,000 a year. Serge didn't particularly want to leave Goldman Sachs just to go and work at another big Wall Street firm, and so when Goldman offered to match the offer, he stayed. But in early 2009, he had another call with a very different kind of offer: to create a trading platform from scratch for a new hedge fund run by Misha Malyshev. The prospect of creating a new platform rather than constantly patching an old one excited him. Plus, Malyshev was willing to pay him more than $1 million a year to do it. And he suggested that they might even open an office for Serge near his home in New Jersey. Serge accepted the job offer and then told Goldman he was leaving. "When I put in the resignation letter," he said, "everyone comes to me one by one. The common perception was that if they had the right opportunity to quit Goldman, they would do that in no time. Several hinted to him how much they would like to join him at his new firm. His bosses asked him what they could do to persuade him to stay. They were trying to pursue me into this monetary discussion," says Serge. "I told them it wasn't the money. It was the chance to build a new system from the ground up." He missed his telecom work environment. "Whereas at IDT, I was really seeing the results of my work, here you had this monstrous system, and you are patching it right and left. No one is giving you the whole picture. I had a feeling no one at Goldman really knows how it works as a whole, and they are just uncomfortable admitting that." He agreed to hang out for 6 weeks and teach other Goldman people everything he knew so that they could continue to find and fix the broken bands in their gigantic rubber ball. 4 times in the course of that last month, he mailed himself source code he was working on. The files contained a lot of open source code he had worked with and modified over the past 2 years, mingled with code that wasn't open source, but was obviously proprietary to Goldman Sachs. He hoped to disentangle one from the other in case he needed to remind himself how he had done what he had done with the open source code. He might need to do it again. He sent these files the same way he had sent himself files nearly every week since his first month on the job at Goldman. "No one had ever said a word to me about it," he says. He pulled up his browser and typed into it the words, "Free Subversion Repository." Up popped a list of places that stored code for free and in a convenient fashion. He clicked the first link on the list. To find a place to send the code took about 8 seconds. And then he did what he had always done since he'd first started programming computers. He deleted his bash history, the commands he had typed into his own Goldman computer keyboard. To access the computer, he was required to type his password. If he didn't delete his bash history, his password would be there to see for anyone who had access to the system. It wasn't an entirely innocent act. "I knew that they wouldn't be happy about it," he said, because he knew their attitude was that anything that happened to be on Goldman servers was the wholly owned property of Goldman Sachs, even when Serge himself had taken that code from open source. When asked how he felt when he did it, he says, "It felt like speeding in the car." For much of the flight from Chicago, he had slept. Leaving the plane, he noticed 3 men in dark suits waiting in the alcove of the jetway, reserved for baby strollers and wheelchairs. They confirmed his identity, explained that they were from the FBI, handcuffed him, searched his pockets, removed his backpack, told him to remain calm, and then walled him off from the other passengers. This last act was no great feat. Serge was 6 feet tall, but weighed roughly 140 pounds. To hide him, you needed only to turn him sideways. He resisted none of these actions, but he was genuinely bewildered. The men in black refused to tell him his crime. He tried to guess it. His first guess was that they had gotten him mixed up with some other Sergei Alenikov. Next, it occurred to him that his new employer, Misha Malyshev, then being sued by Citadel, might have done something shady. Wrong on both counts. It wasn't until the plane had emptied and they'd escorted him into Newark Airport that they told him his crime: stealing computer code owned by Goldman Sachs. The agent in charge of the case, Michael McSwain, was new to law enforcement. Oddly enough, he had spent 12 years, until 2007, working as a currency trader on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. He and others like him had been put out of business by Serge and people like him, or more exactly, by the computers that had replaced the traders on the floors of every U.S. exchange. It wasn't an accident that McSwain's career on Wall Street ended the same year that Serge's began. McSwain marched Serge into a black town car and drove him to the FBI building in Lower Manhattan. After making a show of stashing his gun, McSwain led him into a tiny interrogation room, handcuffed him to a rod on the wall, and finally read him his Miranda rights. Then he explained what he knew, or thought he knew. In April 2009, Serge had accepted a job at a new high-frequency trading shop, Teza Technologies, but had remained at Goldman for the next 6 weeks. Between early April and June 5, when Serge left Goldman for good, he sent himself, through the so-called subversion repository, 32 megabytes of source code from Goldman's high-frequency stock trading system. McSwain clearly found it damning that the website Serge used was called a subversion repository and that it was in Germany. He also seemed to think it significant that Serge had used a site not blocked by Goldman Sachs. Even after Serge tried to explain to him that Goldman did not block any sites used by its programmers, but merely blocked its employees from porn sites and social media sites and such like. Finally, the FBI agent wanted him to admit that he had erased his bash history. Serge tried to explain why he always erased his bash history, but McSwain had no interest in his story. "The way he did it seemed nefarious," the FBI agent would later testify. All of which was true, as far as it went, but to Serge, that didn't seem very far. "I thought it was, like, crazy, really," he says. "He was stringing these computer terms together in ways that made no sense. He didn't seem to know anything about high-frequency trading or source code." For instance, Serge had no idea where the subversion repository was physically located. It was just a place on the internet used by developers to store the code they were working on. The whole point of the internet is to abstract the physical location of the server from its logical address, he said. To Serge, McSwain sounded like a man repeating phrases that he had heard from others, but that to him actually meant nothing. "There is a game in Russia called Broken Phone," he said, a variation on the American game Telephone. "It felt like he was playing that." What Serge did not yet know was that Goldman had discovered his downloads of what appeared to be the code they use for their proprietary high-speed stock market trading just a few days earlier, even though Serge had sent himself the first batch of code months ago. They'd called the FBI in haste and had put McSwain through what amounted to a crash course in high-frequency trading and computer programming. McSwain later conceded that he didn't seek out independent expert advice to study the code Serge Alenikoff had taken, or seek to find out why he might have taken it. "I relied on statements from Goldman employees," he said. He had no idea himself of the value of the stolen code. "Representatives from Goldman told me it was worth a lot of money. Or if any of it was actually all that special, representatives of Goldman Sachs told us there were trade secrets in the code." The agent noted that the Goldman files were on both the personal computer and the thumb drive that he had taken from Serge at Newark Airport, but he failed to note that the files remained unopened. If they were so important, why hadn't Serge looked at them in the months since he'd left Goldman? The FBI's investigation before the arrest consisted of Goldman explaining some extremely complicated stuff to McSwain that he admitted he did not fully understand, but trusted that Goldman did. 48 hours after Goldman called the FBI, McSwain arrested Serge. Thus, the only Goldman Sachs employee arrested by the FBI in the aftermath of a financial crisis Goldman had done so much to fuel was the employee Goldman asked the FBI to arrest. On the night of his arrest, Serge waived his right to call a lawyer. He called his wife, told her what had happened, and said that a bunch of FBI agents were on the way to their home to seize their computers and to please let them in, although they had no search warrant. Then he sat down and politely tried to clear up the confusion of this FBI agent who had arrested him without an arrest warrant. How could he figure out if this was a theft if he didn't understand what was taken? He recalls having asked himself. What he had done, in his view, was trivial. What he stood accused of? Violating both the Economic Espionage Act and the National Stolen Property Act did not sound trivial at all. Still, he thought that if the agent understood how computers and the high-frequency trading business actually worked, he'd apologize and drop the case. The reason I was explaining it to him was to show that there was nothing there, he said. He was completely not interested in the content of what I am saying. He just kept saying to me, if you tell me everything, I'll talk to the judge and he'll go easy on you. It appeared they had a very strong bias from the very beginning. They had goals they wanted to fulfill. One was to obtain an immediate confession. The chief obstacle to the FBI's ability to extract his confession, oddly, wasn't Serge's willingness to provide it, but its own agent's ignorance of the behavior to which Serge was attempting to confess. In the written statement, he was making some very obvious mistakes, computer terms and so on, recalled Serge. I was saying, you know, this is not correct. Serge patiently walked the agent through his actions. At 1:43 in the morning on July 4, after 5 hours of discussion, McSwain sent a giddy one-line email to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Holy crap, he signed a confession. 2 minutes later, he dispatched Serge to a cell in the Metropolitan Detention Center. The prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Joseph Facciapani, argued that Serge Alenikov should be denied bail. The Russian computer programmer had in his possession computer code that could be used to manipulate markets in unfair ways. The confession Serge had signed, scarred by phrases crossed out and rewritten by the FBI agent, later would be presented by prosecutors to a jury as the work of a thief who was being cautious, even tricky with his words. "That's not what happened," said Serge. The document was being crafted by someone with no previous expertise in the matter. Sergei Alenikov's signed confession was the last anyone heard from him, at least directly. He declined to speak to reporters or testify at his trial. He had a halting manner, a funny accent, a beard, and a physique that looked as if he had been painted by El Greco. In a lineup of people chosen randomly from the streets, he was the guy most likely to be identified as the Russian spy or a character from the original episodes of Star Trek. In technical discussions, he had a tendency to speak with extreme precision, which was great when he was dealing with fellow experts, but mind-numbing to a lay audience. In the court of U.S. public opinion, he wasn't well-suited to defend himself, and so, on the advice of his attorney, he didn't. He kept his long silence even after he was sentenced, without the possibility of parole, to 8 years in a federal prison. Chapter 6. How to Take Billions from Wall Street. Ronan didn't intend to tell his father exactly how much money he made, or anything else that sounded like boasting, but he wanted him to know he needn't worry about his son any longer. For Christmas in 2011, he'd fly back to Ireland, as he did every year, Only this year, he'd traveled toward a conversation. He felt no particular attachment to the place. "I don't belong there at all," he said. "There's fucking fat kids everywhere. When I was growing up, there was no fat kids. It's lost its charm." He missed his family, nothing more. When he arrived at their house in the Dublin suburbs, his parents would be waiting with a list of their stuff that needed to be repaired or reprogrammed. After he had rebooted their computer or recaptured their satellite signal, he'd sit down with them and have this talk. "American parents get into their fucking kids' business," said Ronan. "In Ireland, they don't. They mind their own fucking business." His father still had no clear idea what he did for a living, or for that matter, why a big Wall Street bank would find him useful. "He didn't think I was a fucking teller or something, but if I said to my dad, 'I'm a trader,' he'd say, 'What the fuck do you know about trading?'" His life was his life. Theirs was theirs. "My mom and dad, I know they love me. It's just Irish love. And I just kind of wanted him to know I was legit in this business. It was semi to set him at ease. I didn't want him to think I was putting the family in jeopardy." Ireland's economy had collapsed 3 years earlier, under the weight of a lot of American-style financial machinations and bad advice from American financiers. Many of Ronan's childhood friends were still out of work. It didn't seem like the best time to be taking a risk. Just days before Ronan was to fly back to Ireland, however, Brad Katsuyama had called him into a meeting with John Schwall and Rob Park. Brad had wanted to know, if he left RBC to create a new stock exchange, who might leave with him? They'd taken turns answering the same question. "You in?" On some level, Ronan could not believe what he was hearing as he listened to the sound of his own voice. He had spent his entire career trying to get a job on Wall Street, and now that he finally had one, the guy who had given it to him was asking him to throw it away. On another level, the question answered itself. "Too much was riding on me," he said, "and I felt like I owed Brad. He was the one who gave me a chance. I trusted him. He's not a fucking idiot." By the end of 2011, there was something else on Ronan's mind, too. He had now seen Wall Street from the inside. It wasn't as persuasive to him as he had expected it to be. "It's like if I stay here, I'll become full of shit," he said. They were all very much in. What they were in for was less clear. Until they found someone willing to pay for the building of a new stock exchange, they couldn't very well quit their jobs to do it. Ronan's commitment to Brad was less a promise of immediate action than a promissory note to be cashed at some point in the indefinite future. But they did have a goal, to restore fairness to the U.S. stock market, for the first time in Wall Street history, perhaps, to institutionalize fairness. And they had a rough idea, to deploy Thor as the backbone of a strange new kind of stock exchange, to which brokers could send stock market orders so that Thor might route them all to the other exchanges. And yet none of them, least of all Ronan, believed that Thor alone could change the stock market, mainly because they doubted that the big brokerage firms would hand over their most valuable commodity, their customers' stock market orders, to any third party to execute. They also suspected that other forms of unfairness plagued the market, problems that Thor didn't begin to address. "I give what we have right now a 10% chance of working," Ronan told his colleagues. "But with the four of us, I give us a 70% chance of figuring it out." After he left Brad's office, Ronan realized that the talk he wanted to have with his father had changed. He needed his father's advice. He'd already taken one big risk, when he had quit a telecom job in which he had made nearly $500,000 a year for a Wall Street job that paid him a third of that. It had panned out. RBC had just handed him a bonus of nearly $1 million and was asking him if he would like to run the more lucrative half of their stock market trading operation. They told me I could name my price. As his plane dipped toward the Irish coast, he wanted to know if he was out of his mind to quit his $910,000 a year job for one that paid $2,000 a month, money that would quite possibly be paid to him out of funds he himself invested in the new company. His father might not care to know the details, but he'd grasp the gist of his predicament. I wanted to ask him, is there a time when you stop rolling the dice? I didn't know if RBC was that time. But when he finally sat his father down, Ronan realized he couldn't explain even the gist of his predicament unless he confessed the size of his bonus. When I was telling him I'd made $910,000, he about had a fucking heart attack, said Ronan. I mean, he doubled over in his chair. At length, his father recovered, then looked up at his son and said, "You know what, Ro? Your risks seem to have paid off so far. Why the fuck not?" Ronan landed back in New York on Tuesday, January 3rd, 2012, turned on his BlackBerry, and watched the new messages flood in. The first was from Brad, announcing his resignation from the Royal Bank of Canada. As Ronan later recalled the moment, the next 10 messages were, "Holy shit, Brad Katsuyama just fucking resigned!" Ronan knew that RBC's bosses up in Canada had been refusing, artfully, to deal with Brad's insistence that it would be better for all concerned if he not only quit the bank to pursue an idea he had conceived while working for the bank, but also took several of the bank's most valuable employees with him. The bosses in Canada clearly didn't like the sound of any part of this. They assumed that if they stalled for time, Brad would come to his senses. What kind of Wall Street trader quits a secure $2 million a year job to start a risky business? A business for which he doesn't even have the financial backing. At baggage claim, Ronan reached Brad by phone. I just wanted to ask him, what the fuck is going on? Brad told him, in surprisingly few words. He was tired of all these supposedly important people who ran this supposedly important bank nodding politely when he tried to speak to them about something that was far, far more important than any one person or any one bank. They were thinking he'd never do it, said Ronan. And he was like, oh yeah, motherfucker? And he did it. When Ronan rang off, he thought, well, he's pushed me all in. Brad got to work around 6:30 every morning. That first morning after the Christmas break, he went to his immediate superior and told him that he was done. Then he went to his desk and wrote one email to Ronan, Rob Park, and John Schwall, and another to three senior guys in Canada. 5 minutes later, his phone rang. It was Canada, outraged. What the hell are you doing? Asked the senior manager on the other end of the line. You can't do this. To which Brad said, I just did. He left the bank with nothing. No paper, no code, no certainty that anyone would actually follow him out. And not even, as it turned out, a clear idea for a business. Like everyone else in the stock market, Brad had received a jolt when he read that a Goldman Sachs high-frequency programmer had gone to jail for mailing himself computer code. Goldman's sensitivity confirmed his suspicion that, around 2009, the big Wall Street banks, previously distracted by the financial crisis, had finally woken up to the value of the customer orders inside their own dark pools. They were using fear and intimidation to control the technologists, who ultimately could exploit that value. And the culture of finance suddenly was becoming more closed and secretive, which was saying something. The people who now did what Ronan had once done for the big banks and HFT firms, for instance, would not be allowed to see and hear all that Ronan had been allowed to see and hear. And the banks were now using the legal system to make it harder for their more technical employees to leave. I said to Rob, "No fucking around," recalled Brad. He said, "Don't worry, there's nothing I'd want to take from here anyway." They'd be starting fresh. They could use the insights about the stock market gained from Thor, but Thor itself belonged to the Royal Bank of Canada. Their main advantage, their only sustainable advantage, was that investors trusted them. The investors on the receiving end of Wall Street's sales pitches were not, by nature, trusting. Or if they were trusting by nature, their natures were reshaped by their environment. People on Wall Street were simply paid too much to lie and dissemble and obfuscate, and so every trusting feeling in the financial market simply had to be followed by a trailing doubt. Something about Brad had led investors to lower their guard and to trust him. Whatever that was, it was sufficiently powerful that a group of people who ran some of the world's biggest mutual funds and hedge funds, and who controlled roughly one-third of the entire United States stock market, petitioned his superiors at RBC, after he had quit, to allow him to leave so that he might restore trust to the financial markets on a grander scale. And yet, even as he walked away from millions of Wall Street dollars, some of these very people raised questions about his motives. He needed $10 million or so to hire the people who could help him to design his new stock market and to write the computer code that would be the basis for that market. He had hoped, assumed even, that these big investors would supply him with the capital to build the new stock exchange. But 8 of every 10 pitch meetings began with some version of the same question. Why are you doing this? Why are you attacking a system that has made you rich and will make you even richer if you just go along with it? As one investor put it, behind Brad's back, "I have a question about Brad. Have you figured out why he's playing Robin Hood?" Brad's first answer to that question was the thing he had told himself. The stock market had become grotesquely unjust and badly needed to be changed. And he'd come to see that if he didn't do it, no one else would. That didn't sit well, he recalled. They'd just say, "That sounds like complete bullshit." The first couple of times it happened, it really bothered me. Then he got over it. If this new stock exchange flourished, its founders stood to make money. Maybe a lot of money. He wasn't a monk. He simply didn't feel any need to make great sums of money. But he noticed, weirdly, that when he stressed how much money he himself might make from the new stock exchange, potential investors in his new business warmed to him. And so he started to stress how much money he might make. We had a saying that seemed to appease everyone when they asked why we are doing this. He said, "We are long-term greedy." That worked very well. It always got a better response out of them than my first answer. He spent 6 months running around New York, faking greed he didn't really feel, to put money people at ease. It was maddening. He couldn't get the people who should give him money to do so, and he couldn't take the money from the people who wanted to give it to him. Just about all of the big Wall Street banks either asked him outright if they might buy a stake in his exchange or wanted at least to be considered as possible investors. But if he took their money, his stock exchange would lose both its independence and its credibility with investors. His friends and family in Toronto also all wanted to invest in his new company. They presented a different issue. 2 hours after Brad had let them know via email that he was pounding the pavement to raise money for a new stock market, they ponied up, collectively, $1.5 million. Some of these people could afford to take risks with their money, but some had no more than a few thousand dollars in savings. Before he allowed them to invest, Brad insisted that they send him bank statements to prove that they could afford to lose whatever they invested. "Your brother has never failed at anything he has ever done," one old friend wrote to Brad's older brother, Craig, to explain why the new business wasn't at all risky, and to ask him to intercede on his behalf and overrule Brad's decision not to take his money. What he needed was for the big stock market investors who had said they wanted him to quit RBC to fix the stock market, that is, the mutual funds, pension funds, and hedge funds, to put their money where their mouth was. They offered all sorts of excuses why they couldn't help. They weren't designed to invest in startups. The investment managers thought it was a great idea, but the compliance arm simply wasn't equipped to evaluate Brad, and so on. The amount of money we were asking for was so small that it was too much of a pain in the ass for them to figure out how to give it to us, said Brad. They all wanted him to build his exchange. They all hoped to benefit from that exchange, but they all also assumed that someone else would supply the capital to do it. Many had good excuses. It was indeed outside the mission of a giant pension fund to invest in startups. Still, it was disappointing. They're like one of those fucking friends who say, "He'll back you up in a fight," and they don't do anything, said Ronan after one long and frustrating day of begging for capital. You're on the ground, bloody, and only then do they jump in and throw a punch. Some of them were like that, but not all of them. The giant mutual fund manager, Capital Group, pledged to invest, on the condition that they weren't the lone investor, but part of a consortium. So did another, Brandis Investment Partners. And there were several that voiced a sound objection. The business Brad was pitching to them was a foggy proposition, a stock exchange that existed mainly to route their stock market orders to all the other exchanges. How would that work? Thor had worked great, but why did Brad imagine that the predators who operated with such abandon on America's public and private exchanges would not adapt to it? And why did he think Wall Street's biggest banks would subcontract the routing of their stock market orders to his new exchange? Because it was fair. The bank's salesmen ran around every day selling the bank's own routers. They weren't going to turn on a dime and say, "Oh yeah, we've been paid huge sums of money to sell you out to high-frequency traders, but now we're going to give all the stock market orders to Brad, so we can't sell you out any longer." Brad didn't fully understand the enterprise he needed to create until the market forced him to, by not giving him the capital for the enterprise he thought he wanted to create. Fuller understanding arrived in August 2012 in a meeting with David Einhorn, who ran the hedge fund Greenlight Capital. After listening to Brad's pitch, Einhorn asked him a simple question. Why aren't we all just picking the same exchange? Why didn't investors organize themselves to sponsor a single stock exchange entrusted with guarding their interests and protecting them from Wall Street predators? There'd never been any collective pressure brought by investors on the big banks to route their stock market orders to any one exchange, but that was only because there was no good reason to prefer one exchange over another. The 50 or so places on which stocks were traded were all designed by financial intermediaries for financial intermediaries. It was so obvious, it was almost embarrassing, said Brad. That should have been our pitch. Not that we should route the orders using Thor, but that we should create the one place investors would choose to go. That is, they shouldn't simply seek to defend investors on the existing stock exchanges. They should seek to put all the other exchanges out of business. By mid-December, he had sewn up $9.4 million from nine different big money managers. 6 months later, he had raised $15 million from four new investors. The money Brad needed that he didn't get, he kicked in himself. By January 1, 2013, he'd put his life savings on the line.